Hi, and welcome to the Fourth Estate, a chance for you to have a weekly catch-up into the world of media and communications. Transparency 100% guaranteed. My name is Nick Caldwell, and it's great having you along for this week's edition. Coming up this week on the show, Community Media Rules, on this special edition as we look at the significance of independence or truth-telling in media with the surge of community radio in Honduras. And closer to home, we track the success of the online independent news outlet New Matilda off the back of its first subscriber drive. And we find out the meaning of life as dictated by your iPhone. But is the whole concept of Siri just a bit phony? Find out coming up here on the Fourth Estate. I thought it would be great to examine the presence of community radio, particularly in Central America's Honduras, which has had a particularly significant presence since the 2009 military coup regime, known as the coup d'etat, was infiltrated. Under this oppressive regime, independent broadcasters took up an important role to provide a voice that offered an opposition to that which was controlled by the military. And Alfredo Lopez was one of the founding fathers of one of the country's first community radio stations. Named after its dietary staple, translated in English as sweet coconut, the station faced great trials in its efforts to provide a voice of truth for the Honduran people. Caitlin Roberts reports on this prolific figure, as well as examining the background into the presence of community radio in the Central American nation.
Community radio in Honduras did not begin with the heightened popular consciousness after the 2009 coup d'etat. The first true community radio station in Honduras began in the Garifuna community of Triunfo de la Cruz on the north coast of Honduras. It began when a commercial radio host invited a man named Alfredo Lopez to speak on his program. Since Alfredo was part of a group that denounced actions such as land privatization by the very same people that operated the radio station, the DJ was told Alfredo was not allowed to participate in the program or the show would be cut. The organization Alfredo belongs to, the Land Defense Committee of Triunfo de la Cruz, which fights for communally owned lands that face threats from megatourism projects and African palm plantations, decided that a collectively owned and operated radio station was necessary to have a truth-telling media outlet. Here, Alfredo Lopez tells us more about why this social communication project was launched. Once we called a press conference, and the radios came, and some newspapers came. They took photographs and asked us for money to publish the report. And we gave them the money, but the report was never published. So that's when we consolidated the idea of a community radio station, and we began to seek allies. Later, we began to search for the name of the radio, and we selected three names. And what stuck was Sweet Coconut, because during that time, the coconut plague was beginning, and it was a problem. The nutritional diet of the communities is based on coconut. So because of that, the people said, well, it should be called Sweet Coconut. Faluma Bimitu. That's why it's Faluma Bimitu. The people decided. So from there, 2 years later, the equipment arrived. That's the history of the radio. And the first transmission was the 25th of May, 1997. Faluma Bimitu is the name of the station in the native tongue of the Garifuna people. It's Coco Dulce in Spanish and Sweet Coconut in English. Alfredo Lopez heard the first transmission from a jail cell a month after he was arrested. Alfredo is the vice president of OFRANE, the Fraternal Black Organization of Honduras, which is a 33-year-old organization in defense of Garifuna culture and ancestral lands. OFRANE today informs the public through assemblies and a network of five community radio stations on the north coast with emphasis on maintaining the matriarchal structure of Garifuna society. So, of course, the president, Miriam Miranda, is a woman. The peaceful nature of Alfredo's work contrasts sharply with the unfounded charges of drug trafficking laid upon him. Alfredo was imprisoned for 7 years and acquitted.
La radio vino y yo, la primera transmisión, yo estaba en la cárcel ya. A pesar de que nosotros...
I was already in jail when the first transmission came. Even though we worked to prepare the building, to prepare everything, when the equipment came, I was in jail. And my comrades, what they did was buy me a small radio so that I could listen to the radio transmissions. They told me, you have to send letters, you have to send notes to arrange a few things. And that's how we communicated. I received the messages via the radio. And later, I wrote, okay, it would be important to do this. From jail. So from that, we understand a little of the dynamic of this project. It's a very strong method of communication.
The jailer began to search for a Garifuna interpreter to read my correspondence.
So they tried to control the information I was sending. Alfredo's native tongue was silenced while he was in jail for a crime he did not commit. He was forbidden to speak in the Garifuna language, a cited security threat. In a defining case on freedom of speech, Alfredo Lopez versus Honduras, the International Court on Human Rights declared that his human rights to liberty of thought and expression were violated, though the reparations due from the state have not been forthcoming. Today, about half of the programming on Falun Mabimitu is in the Garifuna language. Local music is a defining part of Garifuna culture, and Falun Mabimitu is the first station that local musicians send their new recordings. Live performances are broadcasted over the air and music played as well as words spoken during protests are also frequently transmitted remotely when protesters call into the station and hold a cell phone to the sound. There are very organized local bands that play music. When we celebrate, they come here and play live. When we went to Tegucigalpa to protest, we went with those drums as a weapon. There was a lot of repression against the drummers because the people of Tegucigalpa like that. They go wild. So the soldiers don't like it. And they took away the drums.
Entonces no le gusta a los soldados. Entonces nos quitaban los tambores.
Falun Mabimitu spoke out against the coup. To add to the everyday denouncements of land grabs and other violations perpetrated by the richest people in the country, knowingly running the risk of harassment from authorities. The station was burned to the ground on January 6, 2010, and international and national support was so strong that it was transmitting again exactly 1 month later.
That was a piece from Caitlin Roberts, who is a part of the Honduras Resistance Committee to Protect Journalists. Finding funds for new independent media is always a thorn in the side. New Matilda is an Australian news website of news, analysis and satire that has battled to stay afloat in recent times. Key to the struggle for online media is arriving at a business model acceptable to consumers that can sustain high-quality journalism. For the State Reporter, Nathan Coates spoke to the editor and owner, Marnie Cordell.
What kind of journalism do people get from New Matilda?
New Matilda is an independent website, and we don't cover everything that the other media are covering, but we do try very hard to fill the gaps. As a good example, at the moment we're doing quite a lot of coverage of the strikes that are going on at the Freeport mine in West Papua, and that's an issue that's actually quite big and significant that the other media in Australia aren't covering it at the moment.
In terms of the type of reporting, New Matilda is known for high-quality investigative reporting?
Yeah, we do as much investigative reporting as we can on a small budget, and we also run news analysis.
In 2004, New Matilda began producing how many articles a week, do you know, at that stage?
It was publishing, I think, around 10 articles a week. When I took over as editor, we went daily, so we're now publishing 3 to 4 articles a day.
Between May and October in 2010, New Matilda raised about $150,000 in order to stay afloat. You recently completed another subscriber drive. How did you go there?
We went fairly well. We're asking, it's sort of a different process this time. We're asking people to come on board as subscribers rather than donate a flat rate, which is what the initial fundraising drive was doing. We still need more people to get on board if we're going to survive next year, and that's something that we're going to need to address fairly urgently in the coming months. But I mean, we have about 1,000 people sign up in the month-long subscriber drive, which is quite good.
And so you said you need more at the moment, so things are definitely not comfortable. What? How many more people are we talking about? How do you see the likelihood of success going for New Matilda?
Yeah, things aren't comfortable, but all of the things are in place for us to be a viable media outlet. So it's sort of, we're in this strange position where we probably need about half that again, so about another 500 people to get on board as yearly supporters, which when you think about it is not very many people at all, to make it comfortable to keep going next year.
You've also got the Feed a New Matilda Writer initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We do. So one of the things that we sort of fell short on in our recent subscriber drive was money to cover our contributor budget. So we've launched a site in collaboration with a project called Do Gooder, and it's basically a fundraising drive for our contributors. So it's Feed Ben Eltham, who's our national affairs correspondent, but actually that money is going towards our contributor budget.
And in terms of the pressures day-to-day, I think I read in a Crikey article that you had in the past had subscriptions to daily newspapers, and now that New Matilda doesn't have those subscriptions, that's a pretty tiny sort of change to be making, and goes to just how tight things are.
That's right. It's a really bare-bones budget that we've been running off this year. We've really cut back on costs. There's no fat in the budget at all. And we're still producing high-quality content, and our hits have actually been up this year and last year. So that just goes to show that we are, you know, putting in hard work, and with just a small amount more funding, we could actually do really big things.
Now, in terms of business models, Marnie, for online journalism, a topic that's, debated a lot at the moment, particularly with convergence and so on, What have you tried? What has New Matilda tried in terms of business models, and what has worked and what hasn't?
Sure. Advertising wasn't all that successful for us because we don't have the rate, you know, the hit rates that the major papers have, for example, on their websites. And we also don't really have the prominence that some other sites have. So we tried advertising it, and we tried a sort of free model where the readers didn't pay anything. When we did the fundraising drive, I realised that actually our greatest asset is our community of readers, and what New Matilda offers is a place for those readers to come together and talk and read about things that they all care about. So I think for something that's quite niche like New Matilda, actually, you know, calling on your readership to support you is one of the best models around, and that has been our most successful model of revenue raising to date.
Finally, where to from here?
It's a little bit up in the air at the moment. We're still calling on our readers to support us for next year. At the moment, we can't commit to being online next year, which I think would be a great shame because we are one of the only independent online outlets in this country. It is serious. We need more people to get on board. It's not a huge amount of money, and it's not a huge amount of people that would make it viable and keep another independent outlet going in Australia.
Speaking there to the editor of New Matilda, Marnie Cordell, about their own efforts in raising money from subscriptions, that was Nathan Coates speaking to her. After months of hype, the Apple iPhone 4S went on sale this month, with Australian retailers reporting over 1 million pre-orders for the handset. One of the most prominent features to have emerged on the 4S is Siri, a voice-controlled personal assistant that uses natural voice recognition software to give users almost full control of their iPhone without the need to use their fingers. More than that, Siri seems to have some kind of a personality. The metallic female voice will reprimand you for swearing, attempt to tell a joke, and even has an answer on the ready for those tough questions surrounding the meaning of life. But with every one of Siri's searches being sent back to the Apple servers in California, some people are wondering if this is yet another step in the breakdown of public privacy. Dylan Barber spoke to David Glantz, the director of the Centre of Software Practice at the University of Western Australia, about Siri's role in our continual search for artificial intelligence.
How much has Siri changed the rules of the game for how we interact with communications technology?
Oh, I think we've just seen the beginnings of this, but it really is quite a radical new technology to introduce. I mean, it's not introducing anything particularly new. The technology and the research has been around for some time. What Apple have done really has been to bring it to a platform which makes it actually usable. So, you know, there's two aspects of it, the voice recognition part of it, and then essentially the understanding that the software has of what you've actually said. But the amazing thing is actually what it then does with what you ask it, the questions you ask it, and that's really the radical new feature.
Right. Now, the practical features are great, but Apple have taken things, I guess, a step further and included some features for the sake of what I can only call a personality. You know, Siri replies with a sigh and takes offense when you ask, you know, open the pod bay doors, the famous line, obviously, to HAL 9000 in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And she, you know, also responds to the statement, beam me up with, okay, stand still. You know, aside from being a sci-fi nerd's fantasy, I guess, what does it mean when technology is becoming a conversation?
Look, I think that they strove to give it a little bit of a personality to make it more engaging, and I think that's really in keeping with the way that Apple views technology, that essentially every experience with one of their products they would claim should be a joy to use, and that I think with Siri, that's what they've done. But I think this is only the start of the personalization. I think that I think in future the personality will change and adapt a little bit to the person that the owner of the phone and to what you actually use the phone for.
It might seem like it's talking back to us, but is it all just pre-programmed?
Look, there's a lot of pre-programming in there. What happens is that they do. You can't use the product unless it's connected to the internet. They do rely on a lot of processing on the server back at Apple, and a lot of these responses you can see because everybody's getting pretty much the same. There's a variety of them, but they are similar. The artificial intelligence comes in being able to really essentially have a conversation in the sense that you can, you know, ask it to read a text message and then ask it to create an appointment, and Siri will remember that the appointment is likely to be for the person that you asked that was referenced in the text message. So the artificial intelligence comes in that aspect, but the canned responses are by and large sort of pre-programmed. One aspect that's interesting about all of this that nobody's really mentioned, which I expect to come fairly shortly, is the privacy concerns around this, because there's quite a lot of information being shipped from your phone back to Apple.
What sort of privacy concerns are there? Obviously, there are positive positive features, but are there negative ones as well?
I think there are huge negative issues here, and I think that people will just have to make decisions for themselves as to whether they engage with this, because as you become to rely on this, and especially since all of this information is being shipped back to a server, either Apple has to make it absolutely clear as to what the data is being used for, how long it's going to be stored, etc., or you really have to think twice about engaging with it, because It's at the moment, everything that you do on the phone is really by and large kept on the phone. So if you look up a contact, nobody else knows about it. But as soon as you start using Siri, Apple has basically every little bit of data about you being sent up to the server. So I think that's something that Apple will at some point need to become very explicit about in terms of how the information is being used. And I think we are likely to start seeing people raising those concerns very, very quickly.
Purists have criticized the iPhone's role in technology over dependence. You know, with Siri, it seems like it's the next step. You know, it's suddenly becoming a friend in our phone. Do you think we are relying on technology too much?
I guess in some ways it is actually always hard to go back to a world where you didn't have, you know, personal computers and certainly the move to having a mobile phone has radically changed the way that we work and interact with each other. And I think this is definitely the next progression in that sort of evolution.
Right, yeah, and I guess finally we look at movies perhaps like Iron Man or anything like that, and all that sci-fi world where computers and technology have the intelligence of humans and beyond in the ability to interact. This obviously would feel like the first step towards that, but is that sort of complete goal realistic?
I think that it's been, it's always an elusive goal, but computers are getting faster and faster so that they can certainly give the illusion of being human. And I think that certainly nobody would confuse Siri with a real person, but for most things, and it will actually make a passable job. So yes, I think in the future we will get things approaching a human-like intelligence, but there will always be limitations.
David Glantz speaking from the University of Western Australia to the Fourth Estate's Dylan Barber. And that's all we have time for here on the show today. A big thanks to the financial support offered to us by the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University, as well as the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Technology, Sydney. So until next week, I'm Meg Caldwell. I hope you take care.